the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Sarita, happily not singing any more Christmas songs. She was singing Sunny, accompanied by the incomparable Joe Pastry. And of course, that was a speaking voice of Frank Sinatra, the top pop singing voice of the last century. This is your chairman and board of directors of John Barber's World. It's 5 p.m. Pacific time, right here in Las Vegas. It's December 28th, 2015. 3 days after Christmas Day and 3 months after this Christmas season began. It began in September with what the bankers and retailers call financial foreplay, with a lot of us really getting screwed and a lot of us getting reluctantly screwed, forced to buy a lot of stuff for people we don't even care about. But I am thrilled to say that the city of Las Vegas this past week got the most wonderful Christmas present it could ever get from the Democrats and the Republicans. And that was no debate in town this week. But I do have every Christmas or Christmas season should have sort of one sweet story. But I have a true sweet story to tell you. A Christmas here, of course, was on Friday. And like, I guess, everywhere, our buses, our public transportation has to run, and was running Friday. Anyway, an elderly lady living in a retirement home in the northwest part of the city here, it's an area called Summerlin, very nice, by the way. Well, every morning she used to take her bus and her coin purse to the Orleans Hotel, where she played the penny slots till noon, had her soup for lunch, and then went home. Now, every morning that she got on the bus, though, she always had a little candy or two or something sweet for the driver. And, of course, Christmas was a special day, so she had a large bag of nuts for the driver. And, as usual, she always sat behind him so she could chat with him and feed him the candy. And every once in a while, she would extend her hand now with his bag of nuts. And now, at first, the driver was reluctant to take any, but he didn't want to disappoint this little old lady on Christmas morning. So he took them, and he enjoyed them until he noticed the bag was almost empty. Then he turned around, realizing that he'd eaten nearly everything himself and that she had eaten nothing. So he turned around and he said to her, "Ma'am, I noticed you didn't eat any. Don't you like nuts?" And she said, "Oh, Sonny, I can't eat them. I don't have any real teeth, but I just love the chocolate they're covered with." Oh, God, I do tickle myself. Anyway, now for my first treat for you tonight, or anyone with a mind for truth tellers in America today. Truth tellers like Chris Hedges and Cynthia McKinney and Joe Satilli and a handful of others are outnumbered 100,000 to 1 by the truly evil, deliberate truth deniers and the mentally lazy truth avoiders. And we all know scores of them. But how wonderful these few are. They are that very small, distracting cinder that blinds the eye of evil. And when it comes to the JFK assassination. No one is more truthful or better or more objective, more informative, or more listened to than the dedicated man and the voice behind Black Op Radio, Len Ocenek. Len, thank you so much for being here. You are an absolute treasure. Where are you and how are you and how are your holidays?
I'm up here in Vancouver, Canada. The holidays are fine. There's no snow in Vancouver. There rarely is, I guess, but that's fine. It's always better with snow. But
Are you in your studio?
Yeah, I'm in the studio, in the control room, actually.
Why do you call your studio Fiasco Brothers Radio when everything you put out is not a fiasco? I mean, it's right on. Where did that name come from?
It comes from, I think, like the boy named Sue. I think that, you remember the Johnny Cash song?
Yeah.
So that, you know, we were thinking of a name, and I said, let's just not call ourselves Total Recording or Boring Title Limited, you know, let's just pick something that has got character to it.
Well, it
and,
definitely does have character.
It was almost Bedlam Brothers, I thought. I always liked the Sanford and Son, you know, something in Son and Brothers, and the Brotherhood appealed to me, so... But Fiasco had just a little bit of that humorous charm, you know.
Well, it does, and so do you in person. Len, tell us a little bit about your background. Where you were born, your family, do you have any siblings? And when you were a young teenager at Christmas time, I don't know, getting skates or a hockey stick or whatever, guitar, whatever you got, what was it you wanted to be when you grew up?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's supposing I grew up, okay? I don't know. I really don't know. I was born in Edmonton. I have a brother. I think we just had normal family. Christmases were always kind of fun.
Do you get along with your brother today?
As much as any brothers do, we squabble and get along. And he lives in out east, so
Maybe you should have called it Bedlam Brothers. What was it when you were let's say you got into high school now? What is it that you enjoyed studying and? Did your mind ever focus on something that you really loved to do, or was your life all sort of just happenstance?
I always enjoyed music, so I think I played bass guitar in school band. I used to play they never had really bass guitar parts. I played third drum trombone parts, and so I knew music and, treble clef, bass clef, and we played concert stuff. So I liked music, you know, from about grade 7, 8 on. And
I must tell you now, I'm sure that a lot of people are really going to be surprised to learn this because they know you mostly as the great voice behind Black Op Radio and mostly the material about the John Kennedy assassination. But I'm going to tell my listeners now, if you ever get a chance, you go to my Facebook page and you scroll down and you'll see something called Forgotten Road. And it's Len editing, this magical editing of his wife, Susan, a gorgeous brunette, singing this song that should be a major hit. The whole thing should be viral. You will be stunned, folks, at how wonderful this music is, how beautifully Susan sings, and how great a musician Len is. Len, why didn't you pursue that more? And how on earth did that turn you into somebody who started Black Op Radio and you researched into the Kennedy assassination?
Oh, well, I usually say I lost the bet.
What bet?
It's just a joke. You know,
it's funny.
I started a recording studio because I just had an interest in music, making music, and I had a few bands, and we didn't, I would say, get maybe a lucky break, something like that. I think the difference between a lot of good musicians and somebody who makes it is they have a manager. You know, management, record company, things like that are so important. I see a lot of talented people who just haven't got a lucky break or something, but that doesn't diminish their musical ability, you know.
I must tell you, wiser words were never spoken. I mean, luck, having had my share of good luck and bad luck in this business, plays a major important part. But I will tell you right now, Woody Allen would have disappeared from the planet had it not been for his manager, a fellow named Jack Rollins in New York City. And he created Belafonte, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, this guy that was on late night on CBS for all those years, who bombed on every show he ever did daytime. It was only Jack Rollins' management that made them. I'm sure is the same is true of Elvis Presley with Colonel Parker. And why the Colonel didn't intercede and take that young man off drugs, I don't understand. And there are a few like that, including Jerry Weintraub, who just recently died. So I was never that fortunate, as I guess you weren't that fortunate, but I was lucky to have a fabulous wife, and without that, I would have never gotten Real People started or even on the air. So anyway, back to you losing the bet. You're not a successful musician. Why? Okay, you start the studio. Now you're doing, I presume, pretty well, because there are lots of talent in the Vancouver area. A lot of, I mean, Michael Bublé and a bunch of really other good talents around that area. I presume you were making a decent living. What yeah. was it that happened to you that made you think, geez, I have something to say, or there's something about this Kennedy thing that bothers me, and whatever ever made you do that? And can you remember your very first broadcast, what it was about, and were you nervous about doing it?
I wasn't nervous as much as I was inexperienced. What got me into it mostly is I decided to write a letter to Colonel Fletcher Prouty after listening to a lot of his audio tapes that I was able to get together. I, through a friend who lived in L.A., was able to get a lot of different lectures, various things that weren't around in Vancouver. And we would mail back and forth cassettes, and mostly I'd get them from him and my friend Andy Hill. Anyway, you know, once I decided to write Fletcher Prouty a letter, it really got me very interested because he replied to me, and due to his good disposition, we became friends. And my first letter said something like, I'm not a, you know, writer of the CIA. I'm not in the military. I'm not any critic of this. I'm just an interested civilian. And by the way, I'm a musician, and I run a recording studio in Vancouver, Canada. Can you answer a few questions for me? And he really, you know, just it just speaks to his great disposition. He answered the letter, and then I sent him back a thank you note, and we started conversing more and more. And I wrote him, and finally, I just said, to, you know, can I come visit you? And after visiting Fletcher, it just led to more. The doors opened, the more I asked him about it, the more he would reply about, you know, how the Pentagon, how the world works, how money, how the military-industrial complex works. The good thing is that this is a rare individual. Fletcher was somebody who was there. He worked in the military for 23 years, and then he ended up being one of the top 52 people cleared out of 35,000 in the Pentagon for some of these gold room meetings, you know, briefing the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
It's astonishing that you met Fletcher, because America's greatest philosopher, I believe, was Joseph Campbell, who wrote this wonderful series called The Power of Myth. But he wrote a wonderful book on how to live a happy and successful life. And his lesson to people was to just follow your joy. If you follow your joy, doors that you don't even know that exist in the universe will open for you as if by magic. And it was this. If by magic you got to meet the very best in Fletcher Prouty, because he was one, you say he's one of the 52, he was one of the very few that hadn't signed any loyalty oath or confidentiality oath, yeah. So you got to talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I listened to a lot of Joseph Campbell. He was very influential. Follow your bliss, I think is the exact quote.
Yes, it's follow your bliss. Did I say follow your joy?
Yeah.
Well, but, I meant to say follow your bliss.
Yeah,
but
you're right, you know, and the thing for me that I kind of accepted as a good move ending up, you know, becoming a broadcaster for, you know, with Black Hawk Radio was that from someone who just was into rock and roll and it was into rock and roll lifestyle and everything around that, that as my side hobby, I kind of reached up. I didn't just go sideways. I thought, you know, well, if I really want to, you know, study this and have an interest of how, who killed Kennedy and who the hell did this and how did they get away with it? And it's a kind of an interest that, you know,
was Fletcher the subject of your first show? Do you remember?
Oh, no, he wasn't.
Who was the subject and what was the subject in the first show? Do you remember?
I'll tell you in a second.
Okay, well, I'll tell you exactly
how it happened.
Go ahead.
It was kind of a sideways thing where there was a woman whose band was recording here. Her name was Anita Langley, and she was a paralegal assistant or whatever, paralegal. Anyway, when I was making a CD-ROM for Fletcher, for Colonel Prouty, I thought, I've got all this paperwork. My fax machine was running, you know, almost, you know, 24 hours a day. He was sending me stuff. I was asking for more. He would just put these documents in and you know, fax them to me. I said, I'm making this tribute to Fletcher Prouty, which is articles, letters, documents, essays he wrote that were never published anywhere. And I'm having trouble proofreading them because I'm reading right through all the mistakes. Every time I see A-R-E is O-U-R or something, you know, the grammar spell check wasn't that good back then at all. Mm-hmm. And this is around 1993, I think. Anyway, you know, we became friends. And at the studio, someone had decided that they were going to record, they were going to start a radio show on a big station, which was, at this time, I don't understand how it worked, but it was $1,000 an hour you could be on the radio at this local radio station in Vancouver. And so these women, the three of them, wanted to rehearse a few times in a recording studio to make sure they didn't, you know, all their pitfalls and the bugs had been worked out ahead of time. So they started doing a show, and they were pre-recording these, and I said, you know, I think we can actually broadcast over the internet for you as well if you want to have some listeners in and get calls.
And, oh, how interesting.
Yeah, and so with this show, the three ladies, they had this show called Speaking Of, they started doing that, and then I instantly noticed that because I had telephone lines and I had a recording studio, and I had a pretty good internet connection, I had what I needed to broadcast to the world. So I thought, well,
oh, how
easier
exciting
than I thought.
You have been on now about 28 years?
No. Started in the year 2000. So 16.
Oh, so you've been on 15 years.
Well, 16 seasons because of the 2000 as a season.
Okay, now I don't want you to slight anyone.
No.
Of the half a dozen of these wonderfully interesting people you've interviewed, who impressed you the most? Who surprised you the most? Who informed you the most? Or maybe who disappointed you the most?
In other words, who
have some of your most interesting guests been to you, not necessarily to your audience, but to you yourself?
Well, I'll footnote my answer this way, is that I've learned once with Anita, we don't just blindly have somebody on. So I get a lot of requests for people to go on. And people are mailing me books and said they like to come on the show, they like to come on. I only ask people on if I know something about them, if I've read their book or a few books. So, you know, one time we had somebody on where Anita said, I think this might be a good guest, I don't know who she is. And then, you know, I had I just went with it, and, you know, it was a total flop. We didn't even air that episode. So, but we've done like 760 shows, roughly.
Well, I've listened to most of them. Also,
yeah.
The series that you have, the 50...
Reasons for 50 Years.
50... Oh, my God, Len.
Yeah, 50 Reasons for 50 Years. That's a good series.
It is breathtaking. It is so informative, and it is so professional, and all the work that you put into it. And then the other day, I guess it was maybe 2.5 weeks ago, I listened to Jim DiGiugno. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Jim DiGiugno, yeah.
That's the first time I ever heard him. He was so interesting. And he was so complimentary about your work. Let me ask you a question, and I don't mean to put you in a weird spot here.
Well, you know what? Can you hold that for 1 second? Because you asked me a few things.
Okay, go ahead.
In a row, and I didn't answer.
Okay, go ahead.
I think Mark Lane might be one of the favorite ones. I also enjoy Fletcher Prouty. I play some of the old interviews and things I have with him. Another fella who was a giant is David Radcliffe. David Radcliffe, I look forward if I can get him on once a year. There was, you know, the writer for the Parallax View, Lauren Singer.
Oh, my God. What
you know, I looked for
snail.
Him. Yep. You know, every now and then I looked for a guest, and I thought, I'd like to have that guy on. I'd like to have him on.
Hey, Glenn, do you know the Parallax View? The writer-director who died, who made that film. I met him when I was a mail boy at Paramount, and we became friends, and I was a fan of his when I was a critic. They offered me the part of the senator. He offered me the part of the senator in the Parallax View, and I turned it down because I said, as a critic, it's a conflict of interest. Anyway, God, I hope I remember his name. He did Clute. He did All the President's Men. Oh, my gosh. Shame on me that I can't remember. Anyway, keep going.
Right. Well, there are over 700 shows. There has been a lot of great guests. I don't think there has been anyone that really put out a bad show. If we really had a bad show, like I say, as somebody that came out of the blue and we didn't kind of know about ahead of time, I just didn't air it. And that only happened once. Now, the show is only once a week, so it's not every day. So with once a week, I get to kind of prepare for somebody. So, you know, I have people on who are interesting and have something. Filmmakers, authors, people who have done some research in the JFK assassination or Martin Luther King or Bobby Kennedy. And
Can I ask you someone who is extremely about someone? And I don't mean to put you in a spot, but...
That's okay.
It's about someone that you're well aware of, and you probably have interviewed and may not even air the interview. I get a lot of questions in my emails and on my Facebook about Judith Vary Baker. And a lot of people love her. A lot of people don't believe her. And they ask me my feeling. Now, I read the book, Lee and Me. I enjoyed the book. It was well written. How truthful a lot of it is, I don't know. I do know that obviously she knew a great deal about cancer because as a kid she got the special award. It's in the newspapers. And then there's no doubt that she worked for Osler or whatever that guy was in New Orleans. There's no doubt that the CIA was developing cancer to kill people because our government, the CIA, the secret state, they are interested in finding any way they can to kill people. Okay, I don't doubt that. And people ask me if I believe her. And I say, I don't know. But I do know I find it very difficult for someone who's leading an ordinary life behind the scenes to all of a sudden put her personal life and maybe her personal safety in jeopardy by going out with such a story like this. I mean, 60 Minutes, as you know, wanted to do the story, researched her background, thought she was a fraud, and never did it. So I feel there's something truthful there. Otherwise, she would have never done what she did, but I am not certain. So your thoughts on her?
Well, I'm not certain either. But in my experience, I've relied on my gut when I know someone is talking, you know, about what they know. But when you interview a Fletcher Prouty or you talk to a Mark Lane or Cyril Wecht, when you talk to people who really know what you're talking about, you know, myself, you get this education out of the deal. And when I read her work, and I sat across the table from her. She was one person that I interviewed in the studio. She came to Vancouver. She was here. She sat down in front of the camera for 3 hours, and I never aired that. I didn't believe her. And I know a lot of people do, and it could be that I'm wrong, but, you know, there's so many hucksters and fraud stories, and there's the Gary Max out there, you know, that and the Vincent Bugliosi's, and the people who are just, I don't know, selling a story.
Yeah, the slight difference being Vince Bugliosi, whom I interviewed when he first, on television, he first published Helter Skelter, he was already extremely successful. The fact that he did what he did in claiming Oswald did, it's just beyond belief to me, especially since he wrote a book earlier calling for George Bush to be arrested as a war criminal, which indeed he is. And then you have Stephen King, for God's sake, with that dreadful piece of thing that he did about, you know, going back in time and preventing Oswald from killing Kennedy. Here's one of the great mystery writers in the world, and the biggest mystery is how could a man this intelligent be so goddamn stupid? Yeah. So, anyway, I admire...
And you have the Tom Hanks, well, you know, Tom Hanks and Johnny Carson. You know, there's people who you looked up to, admired, and then they come up with this crackpot stuff. And
it
amazes me that the research community somehow, you know, in everything in Judy's... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the difference is that Judy was not famous. All these people are famous. So you could understand, you know, maybe they wanted to feel more glory. Okay, so like Norman Mailer did, the same thing. He wanted to be in the press all the time. Glory, glory, glory. She risked her privacy to do that. So I don't know. You know, I might even ask her to come on this show because I would pose that question to her. And I would ask people beforehand to send me questions about why, what they would like to ask Judy if they do not believe her and see if she'd respond. Anyway, that's one of the things I admire about you because you do impeccable work. You trust your guts, you trust your heart to tell the truth. And then also, on a selfish thing, when you came down here to interview me, first, I hadn't talked to you in over a year. What on earth prompted you to all of a sudden pick up the phone and say, hey, John, I want to come down and put you on camera for a while? Why did you do that?
Well, the truth is... Not the great story in this one. My wife wanted to go to Las Vegas, and I didn't want to go. Right? And I was trying to get out of it, and I just didn't want to go. And I knew that you lived in Las Vegas, and you know, a former friend, a guy named Pat Valentino, who I was pretty friendly with, and looked up to as well, a researcher. For some reason, I dropped out of contact with him, and I'm not sure exactly why, but I wasn't, you know, I had gone to visit him before. And so I knew of two people that lived in Las Vegas that were, you know, worthwhile doing something with, and that was you and John Armstrong. So I thought, well, if I go there, I'll do something, and then, you know, Susan can go off and go to the shows and all that. You know, I kind of watch you my weight, so I don't go to these buffets that are just, you know, you go to some buffet there. Las Vegas is all about that. $75, all you can eat this, all you can eat that, right? And if you're trying to watch your weight, you don't want to eat too much. And, you know, and I don't drink to speak of at all, really. So,
yeah, honey, I don't want to eat. I don't want to have a good time.
Right?
I'm gonna
what are we going to do there, right? Give me my decaf coffee and my non-alcoholic beer.
Oh, God.
So that's exactly what happened. But I thought once
you were
available.
Your last resort. Well, it's the last thing I'll do, I guess, while I'm in Vegas. But I must tell you, again, Lynn, it was a happy accident. I'm telling you, I say it all the time, that always the best things in life are those that happen by accident, and the worst are those things that are monumentally well-planned, and those things that are well-planned that go awry are usually by major corporations building in Edsel or the government invading Vietnam. Anyway, I must tell you, I would have never done or thought about doing what you did when you showed up at the door and we did this. And I must tell you, I am more thrilled with this, I think, than I am with the Garrison tapes. I'm enormously proud of the Garrison tapes, and I'm so pleased that you think it's one of the most important documentaries about the case. So that thrills me and flatters me no end.
Well, it's one of the best ones, and I'll tell you why, because it stands the test of time. Because when I went to watch that again, I don't know exactly what year you made it. Was it around 1992?
Yes, yes, it was.
Around there, you know, around the same time as the JFK's movie.
Yes.
So I if you've seen my video collection of stuff on the wall or books like you have, I have hundreds of them, and I watched that, then I'd watch another one, I'd watch another one, and, you know, you file a lot of them as bad or just, God, the one by Tom Hanks, the CNN, the 60s, it's just awful. It's just awful, you know. And the whole orchestrated effort by the Sixth Floor Museum and that. And, you know, I was so happy that you were putting something together in Las Vegas when you did that, you know, The Last Word.
Oh, The Last Word and the assassination.
So, you're on my radar. Like I said, I had interviewed you to discuss your work and Jim Garrison and Jim Garrison's great work. And when I reviewed that, going down to interview you again, like I said, I was going to go see, well, John Armstrong and John Barber. I'll go there, and that'll be my trip, and that'll be worthwhile.
And, well, I'll tell you, I am so pleased with it. It's only been up a few weeks, and it's had over 5,000 hits. I don't know if that's good or that's bad, but the wonderful thing, even before the first day it went up, people began to send in contributions. One guy here in Vegas, for God's sake, he's an auctioneer. He sent in, first person to send in, he sent $500 in because they want us to do the part two, which is the American media and the second assassination of President John Kennedy. And some way or another, whether I get it from people out there, you know, if 100,000 people were really interested and sent in a dollar, we could do it easily. But somehow or another, I am going to see that gets made, and I look forward passionately to doing it with you, because when I came out to Vancouver to work with you on putting this thing together, I was just thrilled. And I will tell the audience, I sent them a lot of pictures. Okay, and so I thought, well, we should put a picture over this spot. And I said, I don't need a Rembrandt is good enough.
Well, you know what, John? Do we have a minute right now still?
Sure.
Okay. Well, for people who aren't aware of what happened, I went to videotape John in his home. And I asked him to tell me the story of Jim Garrison and your meeting him and what led to the chain of events that you made your documentary. And we just discussed that, and I think we went out for dinner. Well, later when I came back, I had this interview with John, and I thought, well, let's colorize the story here. Let's cut when John starts talking about that he was on a TV show. I can find that bit of footage. So I started putting footage in along with it, and then I sent you a rough draft, which, you know, it wasn't anything big deal to me. And I think that's kind of reminds me of when I was working with Fletcher Prouty. I said, Fletcher, I got all this stuff here. You should make a CD-ROM. You've got to organize all this. You have these essays, articles, official documents. So with your documentary and, whatever we call this, the latest one.
John Barber's Last Word in the Garrison tapes, and I
tell you. Yeah, so you should make a link to it. I urge everyone to listen to it because it's very interesting. If nothing else, it's interesting if you believe in Jim Garrison or Judy Baker or whoever, if the limousine stopped, people can argue.
Well, you want
forever.
To know something, Lynn? A lot of the comments I got when you say interesting, that is the most descriptive word you could use to describe this. I've gotten just a ton of comments from people who said, I didn't know about this guy Baldwin, this black writer. I didn't even know that guy existed. Here's a guy that's 55 sending me a note saying, where can I get his book? I got from media students studying at UNLV saying, you mean at one time a station, a company could only own 7 television stations? I mean, it's an education. So when you say it's interesting, I appreciate that. And we are going to do part 2 together, that I promise. So where can people hear you? And I know that Susan and Mia Zimmerman, her partner, and her friend did this wonderful 100-year anniversary tribute to Frank Sinatra. I know that you videotaped it. Nobody videotapes musicals better than you, not even MTV.
No, don't go there.
Wait a second. If these people go and look at Forgotten Road, they can see that you're better than anything that MTV puts on the air. As a former multiple Emmy Award-winning critic, I'm telling you that's the truth. And I'm stunned they haven't sought you out to hire you.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I told you that night, I'm trying to make a video a month, right? And, you know, I just said to Susan, come on, it's raining out. Let's go tonight. And I was on the phone to you that afternoon. I said, I think there's rain out here. We're going to go down and film something tonight, and we'll make a video out of it, you know. So that was just something together I threw quick.
It is brilliant. Where can people go to listen to Black Op Radio?
All one word, blackopradio.com. And I still record. I've been running a recording studio for 37 years.
So okay, what day and time does it come on, your show?
Black Op Radio, Thursdays, typically 6 p.m. Pacific
Standard
Time. Is that 6
p.m.
Time.
Pacific Time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the shows are archived, so you can listen to the shows on the archive shows page. And there are wonderful show notes, descriptions of each interview with links done by Chris LeMay. And he lives in Las Vegas.
I must tell you, I am so thrilled that you came into my life this late in my life, because I would have never done that. And I've just gotten unbelievable feedback to it. We will be doing part 2. Please give my love. Sarita sends her love to Susan, too, and to you especially. And I will talk to you after the first of the year. You drink and drive safely.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you, and it's been a pleasure to work with you as well, John.
Thank you so much. I really am proud to know you, Len. Have a terrific night, terrific new year, okay?
All right.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
We'll be right back with the real voice of America when it comes to journalism, my friend and my partner, I guess now, Joe Satilli. We'll be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. Or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film, based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
I'd like to thank George Knapps once again for that unbelievable review about The Last Word on the Assassination. And you go to Amazon and you'll read 100 more unsolicited reviews by people who bought it and then thought so much of it, they went back to write a review. And then for free, you can go to John Barber's World, click on the YouTube icon, and watch John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Takes, about which Len and I just chatted a bit. And right now, to one of my very, very favorite people, and I admire him and like him so much, I want him to be here all the time. And if I had the means, I would give him his own show. He is the best voice of American journalism that I know of. He does the best, most objective, most informative newsletter every day. It's called News Vandal. When I get it, I send it to all my friends, and you should get it. I'm delighted to have him here every time I'm here. Joe Satilli. Joe, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well. I had a good Christmas. I was not schlonged like Hillary Clinton was schlonged by Obama. That's according to Donald Trump. And you know, I have to say, this Christmas I am quite grateful, because for political journalists and political junkies, Donald Trump is literally the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, okay, I'm going to ask you a question to start with. That's sort of Trump is the one trumpeting this cause right now. So that'll be, I guess, my first question is, I lived here for 50 years and I did political humor when I was doing stand-up comedy all the time. Okay. Do you know, and you obviously do know, I just looked at an article by Mother Jones talking about mass shootings in the United States over the last few years. There have been about 10 of these mass killings, hundreds of people killed in the last 3 years, and only one has been a Muslim. And that was at an army base back east, okay? Now, there's some question as to what happened in San Bernardino, because the first news clips that came out of San Bernardino Live, there are half a dozen people, men and women, young and old, saying there were three white men who were the shooters with long rifles who got into a black car. The two Muslims that they found shot were handcuffed behind their back, and the FBI never fingerprinted the place that they lived. That makes that all questionable. So my question to you is, why after 50 years, Joe, is this nation now into Muslim bashing being led by Donald Trump? I have not the foggiest idea, so I need you to answer that.
Money. It's very simple. It's money. The way I look at it, John, and I actually think you know this is a leading question. You know the answer. You know, the greatest cash cow in the history of cash cows was the Cold War. It was a reliable trough that was filled every year. There were times when it ebbed and flowed a little bit, but mostly it just flowed. And, you know, one of the interesting things to me about it is that when George Herbert Walker Bush took over the CIA for less than a year, and as you well know, no CIA director logged in to the Kennedy files, and this is you know, public record, logged into the Kennedy files than George Herbert Walker Bush did in the 1 year he was there during the Ford administration. And when he was there, the National Intelligence Estimate, which was being run through the CIA, had determined, now this is according to Robert Scheer in a great book, the great Robert Scheer, formerly of the Los Angeles Times, who I know you're quite familiar with, in a book called With Enough Shovels. And the title With Enough Shovels was from a Reagan official who said, well, don't worry, with enough shovels, people can bury themselves in the case of a nuclear exchange and they'll survive. So it's not a joke. That's not a joke. Okay. So in this National Intelligence Estimate,
when I can just see Peter Sellers saying that.
You know, it's classic. It's classic Peter Sellers. So when Herbert Walker Bush took over the CIA, the National Intelligence Estimate in the mid 70s had determined. Now, this is after the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. This is after I personally am in the Len Kolodny school of Watergate, and that is that Nixon was removed by an intentionally botched burglary, because he was doing things that the military industrial complex did not want him to do, including detente with Russia more than anything, even more than the opening to China. So what they had determined initially in this national intelligence estimate was that Russia was a fading power, that it was not going to be able to substantially invade Western Europe. It could not engage in a massive land invasion. Its economy was decrepit. It was likely to collapse. That institutions were becoming ossified and rigid. That the population was not generally supportive of the USSR, the regime. All of these things. Well, Herbert Walker Bush comes in, puts in something called Team B to rewrite the intelligence estimate. Two of the names on Team B, Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle,
yes,
names that come up over and over again. And the new intelligence estimate said the Soviet Union was the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. Ding, ding, ding. That it was only 5 to 10 years away from being able to invade Western Europe and take Western Europe. And without a massive increase in U.S. spending, particularly on military and nuclear weaponry, military hardware, nuclear weaponry, that the Soviet Union could defeat the United States in a protracted struggle. None of those things were actually true, and that became the predicate for the massive military buildup under the Reagan years, which enriched a lot of contractors and a lot of the cronies of these people who operate inside the military-industrial complex's representative corps in the White House and in the Pentagon and in Congress. And I think that they knew at that time that the enemy that was the other gift that kept on giving, even better than Trump, that the Soviet Union was going to fade away and die. And they needed a new enemy. And lo and behold, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who himself is kind of a left-wing neocon. There are neocons of the left and the right. I think Hillary Clinton is a neocon. When Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has always had a sort of multi-generational given to a multi-general hatred for the Soviet Union and wanting to defeat the Soviet Union and the Russians, decided to get engaged in guerrilla warfare in Afghanistan. That became the beginning of the sowing of the seeds of what would become an even better gift, if you think about it, which is, as John Carroll once wrote, a never-ending war against an invisible enemy, Muslim terrorists.
Okay, just put a pause there for just a second. The thing about the Muslims. I think you're absolutely right about Richard Nixon being removed because he was expressing detente toward the Soviet Union, and of course that was one of the things that got John Kennedy killed. I mean, his speech that he gave,
American University speech.
Yeah, American University. I mean, that was his goodbye speech, especially to the military-industrial complex. Okay, now, this is going to get to Trump in a second, but last night, I saw late night Jesse Ventura being interviewed by some guy, and the guy had asked him if he was still planning at any presidential aspirations, and Jesse giggled in the way that he does giggle, and he said, yes, I do. And then and the guy said, well, why aren't you in there now? And Jesse said, why waste my money? I'll wait till the two survivors are there, and it could be Hillary, and it could be Trump, and I'll just step in, and I'll demolish them. And
wow.
I'll do, and that's exactly his phrase, I will demolish them. But then he added, only if they let me into the debate. So, first of all, your thought about that ever happening. And then to the business about Trump. Trump has also expressed very openly his admiration for looking forward to talking to Vladimir Putin. So that cannot put him in good stead with these people who run our country.
No, and this is Trump is basically touching every third rail he possibly can.
Oh, God, perfectly said.
And getting away with it. It is – and you know, John, I wrote extensively on Marco Rubio, and the thing that Marco Rubio is that solidifies his support with the establishment. When I talk about the establishment, I'm talking about the establishment of both the left and the right, so-called left and right, the Republicans and the Democrats, the foreign policy establishment that is concerned with the United States preserving its, they call it exceptionalism, but really it's interventionism, its willingness and its ability to intervene around the world on behalf of corporations and the military-industrial complex. And that is the, to use a little Latin, the sine qua non, that's the you must have. If you are going to be, once you hear somebody inside the establishment call it somebody else an isolationist, that means they are not acceptable.
You're absolutely right. And John Perkins wrote years ago about exactly what you're talking about. Now, then the question about Muslims, is ISIS Muslim? Because one of the questions that keeps popping up on my Facebook, on the internet, from people who are not as informed as I am, and I'm not as informed as I'd like to be about ISIS, because I don't even understand it. I heard all kinds of resources about who supplies them and who built them and all the rest of them. But if they were Muslim, why are they trying to attack a military power, the most powerful nation in the world across the Atlantic, when they're right next door to Israel? And if they're Muslim, why aren't they attacking Israelis?
This is a very good question. And my general sort of short answer is because they're Saudi proxies. And this is a war originally between Iran and Saudi Arabia for maybe the battle to dominate the Middle East or control over the soul of Islam. Now you have Sunnis, and that would be the Saudis, and Shia, that would be the Iranians. And that's a breakup that happened, I think it was like 600 AD when you had that schism. But I think there's something a little bit more specific to this, which is the Saudis have a unique brand of Islam called Wahhabism. And Wahhabism was basically this ultra-radical, ultra-misogynistic, ultra-retrograde version of Islam that was contained among camel-riding nomads and horse-riding nomads of the Arabian Peninsula until they found oil. Then all of a sudden they had a lot of money, and I think in the series of deals, the first one made famously between the first king of Saudi Arabia and Franklin Roosevelt, but the most important deal was between the Saudis and Nixon about a year and a half after Nixon, a year or so after he goes off the gold standard, and he says, we will essentially protect you in perpetuity as long as you trade all of your oil in petrodollars. All of your oil in dollars, that created petrodollars, and that pegged the U.S. currency to a hard asset, oil.
Wow, it's amazing you say that, because Saddam Hussein announced just months before they invaded Iraq that he was moving off of petrodollars to deal in euros and to deal in gold. And the same thing happened to Gaddafi in Libya, that he was not going to deal in petrodollars anymore, but just in straight gold.
And at that time, because of the sanctions and restrictions, Saddam's was sitting on an oil reserve that went from fourth or fifth largest to perhaps second or third largest. And Saddam was also saying, because his primary enemy in the world outside of the United States was Saudi Arabia, because he blamed Saudi Arabia in no small part for what happened in the first Gulf War. Because look, if we can unpack this, but there's, you know, the name April Glaspie. She was the representative.
Yes, yes, yes.
And she goes to Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein, who was basically handpicked by the CIA in the late 70s. There was a famous scene that was played in the lead-up as they were selling the Iraq War to the pro-Iraq War of the American people. There was a scene that you might remember, and they show Saddam's – it's kind of grainy. He's in an auditorium, and he's at a podium, and he's calling out names, and the people whose name he calls get pulled aside. – And they would say, ah, yes, this is him killing all of his political enemies openly. And the names that he was calling out were names in the Ba'athist Party provided to him by the CIA to purge other people that could be impediments to his power, and that paved the way for him to take complete control of Iraq, and then paved the way for him to launch a aggressive war against Iran. Many people believe at the behest of the incoming Reagan-Bush administration.
Well, there's also that famous picture of Rumsfeld shaking his hand after they signed a contract.
Oh, yeah, this is what I'm getting at, is that he thought he was Herbert Walker Bush's boy. He thought he was America's golden boy. He had done everything he wanted. You want me to attack Iran? I'll do it. Then during the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, Herbert Walker Bush, there was a little thing called Iraqgate. And this is connected with BCCI, the Banking of Commerce and Currency International. And there were all of these things going on during the first Bush administration that people don't remember. But one is something called Iraqgate. The United States government, the Herbert Walker Bush government, was actually illegally selling weapons to Saddam Hussein in the years and months leading up to his invasion of Kuwait. And specifically, they were selling cluster munitions.
And then the story from that girl who said she was at the hospital where they were throwing babies out the window.
Yeah, well, that's the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, and that turns out to be, you know, about the incubators and everything. But I'm getting into Saddam thought that he was America's number one client, and he had dealt directly with Rumsfeld. He had dealt directly with Herbert Walker Bush. And when he said to April Glaspie, "We are no longer going to allow our 17th province to act with impunity," the Kuwaitis were slant drilling under the border into Iraqi oil fields.
I remember that.
And April Glaspie said, "We have no opinion on your claims to the 17th province." And that's what he called Kuwait, because Kuwait was created out of whole cloth by, among others, a young George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the original hero of Kuwait. So when he invaded, he basically, some people believe, and I think even Norman Schwarzkopf makes a little bit of a hint about this in his biography, that he was goaded into that invasion. And then the boom was lowered on him. And in no small part, what that did is that kept his oil in the ground. See, this is the thing people got to realize. A lot of oil politics is not just about getting oil out of the ground. It's about keeping it in the ground. Because all throughout the 90s, people forget that oil fluctuated between $10 and $17 a barrel. Imagine if Saddam had his oil on the open market, oil might have been $6 to $8 a barrel.
Okay, back to Trump slightly.
Sorry about that.
No. It's so interesting. Not only is it interesting, but it is also obvious. And if it is also obvious, why are these fake wars continuing with these fake politicians who don't talk about the real issues? I mean, Bernie Sanders has the only honest commercial on television, the only honest political commercial. He is the only one who has the balls and the brains to say no student in the United States should have to pay tuition to get an education. I mean, who would say that? In other words, he would dispense with student loans, which pays the government and the banks more than they earn from the oil companies in taxation.
That's absolutely true. People don't realize this, that over 92% of the $1.3 trillion owed to the federal government, and it's one of the most profitable parts of the federal budget are student loan servicing payments on the federal budget to the federal budget.
I mean, I would sort of cheer, you know. Over the holidays, I guess it was upsetting to see people in Minneapolis shutting down a mall or shutting down an airport in Chicago and saying Black Lives Matter. I would like to see a million students on the streets shutting down freeways and markets and malls and businesses saying Students' Lives Matter. And, you know, I'm sure if somebody came along like a new Mario Savio when he was in Berkeley back there in the 60s and the 70s, they'd probably off him too. But with Trump, with his open affection for Putin, Do you think that puts him in a precarious position? And as sort of a sidebar, I've got to tell you, I'm so glad you brought it up. I have, there's a lady fan of ours who listens to the show, loves the both of us, listens every time we come on, and she's from the Ukraine and speaks Russian. So she gets to listen to Putin in Russian and really what he is saying. And evidently it's a lot stronger and a lot more meaningful and a whole lot more intelligent than what our press tells us it is. So anyway, your impressions about what might happen to Trump should he continue this friendship with Putin.
Yeah, I do think that, look, Trump is telling just enough truth to be dangerous. And this thing about Putin is to me, it's incredible that he's going there, because we are back now to the original cycle, because the neocons who have been driving the foreign policy establishment on both sides, they still have it. We're on internet radio. They have got a hard on for Russia. They cannot let go of this. This is a generational thing going back to, you know, Cossacks, and it's a generational thing of their families fleeing Russia. I think that's a big part of it. They still want Russia. The Obama administration, particularly under the guidance of Hillary Clinton, they basically manipulated Victoria Nuland, who is, by the way, married to Kagan, who is one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century.
Oh, my.
She basically organized the overthrow of the Ukrainian government, which led to the presidency of Poroshenko, who, by the way, is called the Chocolate King. The interesting thing about the Chocolate King is that Ukraine used to be known as the breadbasket of Russia.
Yes.
Because it provided a huge portion of the food for the Soviet Union. And U.S. corporate agribusiness interests have been trying to get into Ukraine forever, and that's, I think, a part of what was going on with the switchover. There was a story today in Reuters where Biden says he has spent 1,000 hours on the phone with Ukrainian officials. The Obama administration is trying to get Ukraine to accept all of these austerity measures, all of these reforms. In other words, that's a euphemism for allowing American corporate interests greater access to Ukrainian resources.
Well, I must tell you, Joe. Honestly, one of the greatest thrills for me at any time or any stage in my life is learning something new. And every time I talk to you, I learn these wonderful, wonderful things. I learn things also tonight from Len. I mean, to me, that is absolutely thrilling. And so where can people go to get your unbelievable news, Vandal, other than here? Where else can they hear you? So please tell us.
Yeah, you can just email me at info@newsvandal, newsvandal.com. Put sign up in the subject line, and you will get the rundown 5 days a week. I take the weekends off, but you'll get it 5 days a week. And it's I go to hundreds of sources every week and every day, really. I start very early, and you'll get a good idea of what's going on in the news cycle. Frankly, all you have to do is read the headlines. If you just read the headlines from start to finish, it'll take you about 10 minutes. You'll probably know more than most of the people anchoring the news on cable news.
That is so true, because that's the first thing I do. When it pops into my email, I just scan down and read the headlines. Now, where can they listen to you next?
Yeah. You can listen to me tomorrow night, 6 p.m. Pacific time on the Ocelli Effect. I'm joined Chuck Ocelli every Tuesday night for an hour from 6 to 7. And then I have my weekly show, Inside the Headlines with a News Vandal, on KRUU-FM. That's Kru FM, KRUU-FM. It's a terrestrial radio station in Fairfield, Iowa, but you can also listen to it live on the internet. And then, of course, John, it is always my great pleasure and great honor to join you every other week here on John Barber's World.
Well, I will hear and see you again and talk to you again in 2 weeks. Until then, you have a fabulous new year, Joe. You are indeed the best. Thanks so much.
Happy
again.
New Year.
Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy New Year, everybody.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. sunny, sunny, sunny.